singer-songwriter, guitarist, Kate Peterson of Ypsilanti here, our Live Music Friday guest here today. Kate's a Michigan State University grad, and she is performing tomorrow at the Women in the Arts Festival in East Lansing. She's an organizer of that event, and we're going to hear more about the event and more music performed live here from Studio S from Kate Peterson coming up before the hour is through on WKAR's Current State. It is Friday the 13th. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us here today. At the top of the program, Michigan's advocates of transparent government were confronted by a jarring report card this week. A pair of nonpartisan, nonprofit organizations, the Center for Public Integrity and Global Integrity, showed Michigan ranked 50th out of the 50 states in terms of transparency, accountability, and ethics. The CPI says its annual State Integrity Investigation is a data-driven assessment. Our next guest says Michigan has earned the dishonor. Rich Robinson is the outgoing director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, a watchdog organization that monitors the influence of money in Michigan's electoral process. He's been an outspoken critic of dark money and other forms of non-disclosure. Rich, welcome back.
Thanks, Mark.
Did the dead last ranking, 50th out of 50, did that surprise you?
It really didn't. I mean, I've been, as you say, critical of unreported spending and the unreported contributions that pay for that spending going back to the last century. And a lot of the other elements that were called out in this report from Center for Public Integrity are well recognized. I've been writing about a number of them for over 10 years.
Yes.
So in a very real sense, I think we should have expected this grade. I consider Michigan to be the dark money capital of American politics.
Well, I want to give you a chance to comment on each of the bigger pieces that's alluded to in this report. We'll lead with the dark campaign money that goes into campaigns that cannot be traced back to identified individuals, which is a focus of your organization. The report suggests dark money in Michigan is too influential. Why do you agree with that?
Well, just looking at the 24 election cycle, most of the money spent in the gubernatorial campaign was not reported to the State Bureau of Elections. In fact, a third of all money spent in our candidate elections in 2014 was not reported to the State Bureau of Elections. Why does that matter? Transparency is inoculation against corruption. If we don't know who's putting money into politics, we don't know what considerations they seek, what considerations are granted to them. And that's what corruption is. So it's really a gross violation of this fundamental protection of having transparency be our inoculation against corruption.
What do other states have that Michigan doesn't have that you would argue we need?
Well, the principal instrument of evading disclosure is to form campaign advertisements as phony issue ads. And by that, we construct a communication that doesn't explicitly say vote for or vote against a candidate. It merely says, call Bayshore and ask him why he hates children and the elderly. And this kind of an ad runs the week before the election. It's a thinly veiled effort to characterize the suitability of a candidate who's running for electoral office.
And this issue specifically, just a couple of years ago, Secretary of State Ruth Johnson proposed changes in the very law that you're talking about here, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, this was instigated by a request from the State Bar of Michigan in recognition of the fact that all this dark money in our state Supreme Court elections really undermines trust and confidence in the impartiality of the judiciary. Secretary Johnson said she couldn't take on just judicial elections, but the point was correctly made that the language of our statute actually said if there's clear inference of support or opposition, it's a campaign expenditure that should be disclosed. Well, the legislature acted quickly to amend the definition of a campaign expenditure requiring words making explicit reference to voting. And to my eternal disappointment, Governor Snyder signed that bill into law. Mm.
Let's assume a novice to this discussion, Rich, somebody who simply doesn't pay a lot of attention to elections, which may well be a lot of people. How does this lack of disclosure harm the process?
Well, again, we don't know.
You've described it as an inoculation, but what does it prevent?
Well, the point I was trying to make earlier on, that people don't give 5-, 6-, and 7-figure contributions for selfless reasons. They're seeking some form of consideration. And we need to know who the donors are, what considerations they seek, what considerations they're granted, so we know that people aren't simply buying public policy, but public policy really serves the broad public interest, all citizens. So if you don't know the nature of those financial relationships, you don't know what's going on.
We're talking with Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network about the Center for Public Integrity report, along with another group called Global Integrity, which showed Michigan ranking 50th out of the 50 states in terms of transparency, accountability, and ethics. The philosophical argument, before we get into the other components of this report, The philosophical argument against greater regulation of campaign finance includes a number of U.S. Supreme Court rulings that essentially equate political money with free speech, which is protected by the First Amendment. Why shouldn't political money be considered a form of free speech?
Well, I'm not arguing against free speech, nor any limitation on people spending money. I mean, that's a futile argument in the post-Citizens United era. What I'm arguing for is accountability for that speech. So we know who the speaker is. So we know who spends $10 million on a Michigan gubernatorial election campaign. Information we're currently lacking. So it's not an argument against speech. It's an argument for accountability for speech.
Back to Michigan's poor showing in these reports. We got an F for our lack of a financial disclosure law for public officials. What needs to happen there in your view?
Well, people need to make statements of what their financial interests are. And this is not some kind of voyeuristic effort to see what's your net worth or something like that. But it's so there is on record what your personal financial interests are. So when a matter comes up for you as a voting legislator that involves your personal financial interests, you're obligated to stand aside from voting in your own personal financial interest. It's really as simple as that. Now, one example of how this has worked in the past in the public interest, you remember former Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham from San Diego, who ended up going to prison for responding to bribes. He was really found out because of personal financial disclosure. The value of his home was a public record, and when it was sold for an amount much greater than its value and then resold at a loss, an enterprising reporter tracked all that down. Again, going back to personal financial disclosure, that was how that episode of corruption was unearthed.
Also in Michigan, both the legislature and the governor enjoy protection from the Freedom of Information Act. How big of an impact does that have?
Well,
we're getting away from campaign finance
absolutely.
But you've thought about these things.
And these are the many metrics that were being considered here. This is a balance. The arguments from the executive office and the legislature against having freedom of information apply are that this will disclose confidential information about constituents that we don't want to happen. Well, that kind of information can be redacted, but when you have, again, one example going back to a year ago is there was some question about whether the governor's own cousin had been given special consideration in a bid to sell furniture to the state of Michigan. I'm not sure how that information, the internal communications, got out to face the criticism. But that's the kind of thing that people are seeking. Are there special deals going on? My guess is precious little would be disclosed through a state official email program anyway. My guess is the Hillary Clinton syndrome of using a private email account is much more common in public life than anybody'd really like to recognize.
Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network is our guest. We're talking about Michigan's low grade here from the Center of Public Integrity regarding transparency and accountability. A really common storyline following Citizens United is that campaigns will be flooded by money supporting conservative candidates from the Koch brothers, often you'll hear. And to be sure, a lot of that has happened, but I want to introduce another thread to this. Apparently, CPI data also show that in the 38 state elections that happened in 2012, groups supportive of Democrats, primarily labor unions, actually outspent the Republican supporters by about 8%. And John Dunbar of CPI, I'll read a quote of his, "The narrative has been that Citizens United is just going to help corporations, and people have forgotten that you can take unlimited union money too," unquote. Does the fact that both sides of the political spectrum take advantage of these opportunities make an imperfect situation any more tolerable?
I don't think so, Mark. I mean, what we're seeing across the board is that the independent spenders, some of whom do report their spending and many of whom who do not, are really overshadowing the on-the-record candidate campaign committee. So this happened in our 2014 gubernatorial election campaign, much of it to pay for advertising, but to touch the point about unlimited spending by unions, we had a group of union finance super PACs come into Michigan and support a $3.2 million ground campaign in support of Mark Schauer in 2014. I haven't seen that story reported anywhere. I wrote about it in our Citizens Guide, but it's an illustration of how high-spending interest groups have really taken the campaigns away from the candidates themselves. And we're seeing that in the presidential campaign now.
I wanted to go there. You're a very political animal. What stands out for you in the presidential campaigns here for both parties?
Well, that for most of the candidates, the single candidate super PACs supporting them are grossly overshadowing the candidates' own campaigns. Now, we haven't seen reports from the super PAC since June 30th, rather. But at that point, the single candidate super PACs had raised $250 million, way more than the candidates had. Jeb Bush's Right to Rise super PAC had raised $100 million by itself. How does that compare to last presidential election cycle? Well, the presidential super PACs had raised $15 million. All super PACs put together had raised $25 million. So 10 times as much super PAC money supporting just single presidential candidates as all the super PACs 4 years ago. There's no way to project where this is going. There are a lot of people who have a lot of money and really want to have an influence in bending the trajectory of political campaigns.
You are leaving your position as director of Michigan Campaign Finance Network. You're going to join the board, I understand. We want to wish you the best and congratulations on a lot of important work.
Thanks, Mark.
Rich Robinson, the Michigan Campaign Finance Network here on Current State.
The air is as close as a tire to the road, and the sun is as bright as a midnight headlight, and the lake is as clear as your voice in my ear, and you sing to me softly, coloring time with melody and sound of the song is a sweet sing along, but it's only one that we would know, 'cause we make it up as we go, and it sounds like what it feels like. La 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 la, la 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 la, lucky. Carry us as long as we have each other to lean on, and it feels like what it sounds like. La 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 la, la 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 la, la. Lucky, lucky, lucky.
Kate Peterson, live in Studio S here on Current State's Live Music Friday. That's called Lucky.
You guessed it.
I'm observant like that. You're sounding great. We're glad you're here today.
Thank you so much.
More from Kate Peterson coming up in just a little bit. Kate's performing tomorrow at the Women in the Arts Festival in East Lansing. It's the 30th anniversary of that festival. I'll also point out, for those of you who don't know it, today is Melissa Ingalls Benmark's last day at WKAR, and I know she's been kind of blown away by all of the supportive, grateful, nostalgic online comments that you, our listeners, have left at WKAR.org. If you haven't joined those folks, if you'd like to say goodbye to Melissa, we encourage you to do so, WKAR.org. You can't miss it. During the Vietnam War, there was a lot of tension between police and war protesters. Cops and hippies were clashing over almost every issue, but for a time in the early 1970s, the two factions did have a common meeting place, Spartan Stadium. Current State Scott Pohl is here with a look back at the Pigs versus Freaks football games. How did football bring these two factions together, Scott?
Well, Mark, you know, people who've lived here a long time will remember this little amateur football game called the Bull Bowl bursting onto the scene. It outgrew its humble beginnings and had to be moved to MSU to accommodate the crowds wanting to watch the Pigs versus the Freaks on the gridiron. I spoke with a couple of men who played in these games, a pig, retired Lansing cop Doug Pollard, and a freak, Bob Every. These games were so popular that a documentary film was made about the rivalry, complete with game play-by-play from MSU football announcer Bob Sherman and narration by Terry Braverman.
In the good old days, East Lansing, Michigan was just another Midwestern college town, home of the state capitol, Oldsmobile, and Michigan State University. But that was a decade ago. Since then, MSU has been the scene of riots, demonstrations, and sit-ins. On these streets, the police have clashed with the students over issues ranging from war to parking tickets. But something changed here a few years back. Two police officers tried to kick some college students off a high school football field. The Longhairs responded with harsh words and challenged the cops to lay down their guns and meet them on the playing field. That first year, 16,000 fans turned out to see the Freaks win by a single point. The Pigs' battle cry was wait till next year. Next year came and the Freaks won again. And here it is, the third annual Bull Bowl. The Pigs have never won. The Freaks have never lost. It's the Pigs versus the Freaks.
Doug Pollard, let's start with you because you played in the very first Pigs versus Freaks game.
Mike Harrington was a police officer with East Lansing Police Department, and he was one of the officers that confronted the youth. And he contacted me because he knew we graduated from high school together. And he told me about it. So I reorganized the guys from Lansing Police Department. He contacted other police departments. And in the long run, we got about 30 guys from area police departments to play.
Now, the second year, because of the big turnout that first year, the game was moved to Spartan Stadium, right?
Correct. The idea of the game was any proceeds they got from the profits would go to charity. And St. Jude got involved the second and years after that. And they provided the funding to equip both teams. And Michigan State got involved. And we eventually had our second game at the stadium at Michigan State.
Bob Every, here's where you join in, because you didn't play in that first game, but you were part of that second game and a few others after that, right?
That's correct. I mean, this thing grew into a monster, monster promotion. And, you know, when you can put 35,000, 40,000 people in Spartan Stadium to watch a bunch of freaks go at it with excuse my language, the pigs.
We're going to excuse the pigs and freaks language for this episode only.
You've got quite a little attraction, and we respected one another. I mean, the pigs played hard, the freaks played hard. I don't know what the pigs expected out of the freaks, but I knew that we as freaks were going to get, going to get a big charge from the police, because they're proud people, they're hardworking people, but it was just a great entertainment value for people that wanted to come out and watch a football game with a little different spin.
How serious was the football? How much planning went into play selection and who played what positions and all of that? How serious
was
this?
Well, we had several coaches, as you guys did from the pigs, that had great knowledge of the game, and they formed us together as several coaches, and then we had about 40 guys, and we practiced every night right out behind People's Church there in East Lansing, and we went through standard plays, and people were expected to pull their wagon. And this wasn't playground childhood play. This was serious football practice, and we had a lot of pride, and we did not want to get beat no more than the pigs wanted to get beat. So I a lot of preparation went into the planning of this thing.
You had serious coaching.
Oh, very serious coaching. You know, we had Charlie Wilson, who was an ex-college player, Gary Bedall, Mike Long. I mean, what Charlie Rose, and really, let's face it, Charlie Rose, the old owner of Beggar's Banquet, he's the one that started this whole thing. I mean, Charlie was not a great athlete himself, and he did get involved in the coaching later on when he found out that his chances of playing was maybe a little bit less than he would have wanted. We took great pride in this, and we worked very hard at this.
Doug Pollard, I want to ask you about how seriously the cops took preparation for the Pigs versus Freaks games and the coaching, all of that.
Unfortunately, the preparation that we had for the games was very minimal because we all had full-time jobs.
And a lot of the freaks maybe didn't. Is that right?
That was our assumption, that they didn't work, which was not right, but at that time, that's what we thought. The first game, we practiced two different times before we played. In the subsequent years, we may practice five or six times. The first coach we had was a former coach at Everett High School, and then the subsequent years after that, we had a Chuck Ginther, who was an athlete at Sexton High School and a college player at Hillsdale College, and he coached us.
The odds are against us, you guys. I'm not kidding you. 100%. We're picked to lose by 23. And this isn't by just what people are saying. This is by the bookies. It's unbelievable. They got money going on the Pigs Freaks, but it's a fact.
We had a few college players that graduated and played football who came out for the team, but most of our players were guys that had high school experience only. We were dedicated at what we were doing, but we just didn't have a lot of time to prepare.
This might explain the success the Freaks had in the games.
Plus, the youth, they were
younger.
Most of them were a lot younger than what we put on the field. I was 31 years old when I started, and most of those freaks, quote, were probably in their late teens and early 20s.
We're talking with Bob Every, the executive director of the Greater Lansing Area Sports Hall of Fame, and Doug Pollard, a retired Lansing Police Department sergeant, looking back at the Pigs versus Freaks games that were held in East Lansing in the early 70s, where hippies were playing against police officers to raise money for charity. I want to find out about the equipment and the uniforms, and I'm asking partly because Bob has supplied me with some great photos from that era, And I noticed the helmets especially. I want to talk about the helmets in a minute. But tell me about where the Pigs and Freaks got their uniforms and equipment.
First year that we played, we borrowed the equipment from East Lansing High School. They provided all the equipment for other than shoes.
For both teams?
As far as I know, it was for both teams.
Okay.
And then the subsequent years, Danny Thomas's organization, St. Jude, provided the funds to purchase the uniforms. So we had the police, or the Pigs, had red jerseys and white pants and red helmets with a pig on the side. And the Freaks had black uniforms with black helmets and a marijuana leaf on the side of the helmet.
That must have been a target for the cops, the marijuana leaf on the helmet.
We loved it.
This year, we're going to even be better. Last year, we was a victim of circumstance. So like a lot of times, I think a guy tried to put some handcuffs on me in the game, but the referee didn't see it. So this year, I'm prepared for anything, you know.
Do either of you have recollections about why these games maybe didn't continue? It just fizzle out?
Strictly liability.
Oh, liability.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know what a serious thing liability can be in if it's not in the right hands. But, that's the number one reason was that we had trouble getting the insurance money. And, of course, on the upside of the Pigs having steady jobs, they generally had some medical, but you know, us Freaks who were just staying home smoking dope all day long, we didn't have a lot of medical. So, that was the key factor, was that they were afraid of a serious injury. And there were some injuries. I don't, thank God, there were no serious injuries, but, you know, other than lacerations and bruises and breaks and stuff. And I don't know, Michigan State, maybe they'd lost. We had it there at the stadium for several years, and you know, maybe they were just tired of it and they wanted to move on and do something else. I don't know how liability affected them, but it certainly affected the teams.
Doug, are you recalling it the same?
Yes. Primary concern for the police officers involved was the administrators of the various departments became concerned because of potential injury and losing one of their officers for a time period that may not be beneficial to the department. And over that time period, it just kind of dwindled down with a lot of other reasons, as Bob explained.
There's one last thing I'd like to ask both of you to reflect on, and that is that it would seem to me that at least one hoped-for byproduct of playing this game was the reduction of tension between cops and hippies. Did it result in that? Did cops and hippies get along? Was there a reduction in tension, Doug?
You have to look at it from the point that the police officers that were involved in this and the hippies that were involved, the relationships that were developed on the field and afterwards in going to the parties that they'd have after the games down at Beggar's Banquet, where we got to talk and meet with each other, those individuals had a better understanding of each other. But in the overall picture of it, with you're talking 30, 40,000 students at Michigan State and then including the communities and everything else, they did not have that exposure. So consequently, no, there wasn't a lot of benefit from it.
Bob, what do you think about that?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think being a police officer is positively the hardest occupation in the world to be. I mean, outside of that, it's a soldier or something like that. But it's a thankless job, first of all. I mean, thank goodness that we have them. And personally for me, I never looked at the police or the Pigs in a way that a lot of other people maybe looked at them. But, you know, as we grow older, we realize that we all need each other here, you know, and life is really precious. And I felt that playing this game really established a meaningful relationship between Freaks. And there are a lot of guys on that Freak team that were influential throughout the community amongst their own groups. And I think that they brought a different awareness to the police department that I think if the police department knew what was going on, they would say, we appreciate that, you know. Even though we played the game hard, we hit as hard as we could, we played as hard as we could. But as Doug said, when it was all over, you know, we were down to Beggar's Banquet, we were having our beer or our pop or whatever it was we were having, and we were commending each other for a job well done in the name of charity.
Bob Every is executive director of the Greater Lansing Area Sports Hall of Fame. He was a Freak in a few of those games. Bob, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Scott.
And we've also been talking with retired Lansing Police Department Sergeant Doug Pollard. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, sir.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Payne Show, a round on, pitch sweep to Miller. Miller, stopped at the 2-yard line. He cannot get those two, and the score remains Pigs 14, Freaks 13 at the Bowl Bowl.
This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR, our Live Music Friday guest today is Kate Peterson, along with Kate's solo work. You may know the singer-songwriter as half of the folk duo Nervous But Excited. She is performing tomorrow at the Women in the Arts Festival in East Lansing. She's also an organizer of that event. Let's listen to another one from Kate Peterson. This is called Roots.
Got a friend or two. Said dig into the roots. There's something in there. It's waiting for you. Yeah, got this face. It shows I'll be okay. But I've been finding the lines aren't lying. Yeah, ooh, 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 ooh. And I got this lady. She's been saving me from all my games of wait and see. And I got this patience. It's been dragging behind me. It's the weight of days. Yeah, ooh, ooh, ooh. And the days aren't getting any longer. And the ties are surely growing strong.
Nice. That is called Roots, and you're hearing Kate Peterson live in Studio S here at WKAR. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You have a really nice sound. You've described it as pleasantly aggressive.
It's true.
Which I got a kick out of. Talk to us about your music. Is songwriting at the heart of this, or do you cover other people's stuff too, or is it really about your own expression?
You know, it's a... it's a little bit all of those things. It's kind of evolved over the time that I've been performing. Songwriting is certainly at the heart of it. I think
it's, most of what you do is your own stuff. Then.
Yeah. I do love covering other songs. I do quite a bit of that as well, just for fun. I've recently taken to covering rock ballads of the 70s and early 80s, and mostly either on the ukulele or a slowed down kind of.
Give us a couple titles.
Let's see. To Love Somebody by the Bee Gees.
Of course.
And there's a Journey tune I recently learned on the ukulele.
What's the Journey on ukulele?
That, yeah.
What, do you remember the track?
I do remember. Oh, Faithfully. Faithfully.
Oh, okay. Yeah. How long have you been singing? How long have you been serious about music?
Probably since right about when I spent most of my time in this building, I think, was when it started.
You're a graduate of the Comm Arts School at Michigan mm-hmm. State.
Yeah, I recorded my first CD, which I don't usually talk about, that exists in the next door in that studio over there, and it just kind of blossomed from there. But yeah. It definitely started here.
You said you started out your when you got serious about it. About the time you graduated from college, mm-hmm. or thereabouts.
Yeah.
You started out with three goals. What were the three goals?
You know, it was interesting because I'm not usually one to make definitive statements like this, but someone asked me, and they all felt extremely lofty at the time. And but one of those was to open for Ani DiFranco. The second was to headline a show at the Arc in Ann Arbor. And the third was to play on a stage at the Michigan Women's Music Festival.
Check, check, check. Are you 3 for 3?
I'm 3 for 3.
How about that?
So
congratulations.
Yeah,
got to come up with some more goals.
I guess so. I would like to just write some more songs. That's my current goal.
To write the best songs you can.
Yeah.
Well, you're a great performer as well. We're really glad you're here. You're an organizer of the Women in the Arts Festival in East Lansing. At Edgewood United Church, and this year it's the 30th anniversary. You're performing tomorrow. What happens at the festival?
Well, it's kind of a beautiful marriage of arts and music. We have a massive artist market where many different women sell many different goods, a lot of which are handmade or just produced by them.
And this is all at the Edgewood? Church?
Yep.
It all happens there.
Okay. It's a wonderful space. There's great food that's made by Systrom, the Lansing Women's Chorus. And there's a day stage tomorrow, as well as a film. And tonight is Cheryl Wheeler, which is co-produced with the 10-Pound Fiddle. And Cheryl Wheeler is one of my favorites, so I'm really looking forward to that show tonight.
She a Michigan performer or coming from elsewhere?
I think she's actually from Massachusetts. She's been performing for decades, and she's just a perfect combination. She'll make you cry, but definitely make you laugh, and it's a real experience to see and watch her perform. So
Cheryl Wheeler, Systrom Lansing Women's Chorus, a duo known as Jane of Arc, and the band Scary Women.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Peterson is our Live Music Friday guest today ahead of this Women in the Arts Festival in East Lansing this weekend. Some of our listeners know you've been part of a duo, Nervous But Excited,
mm-hmm.
for some years, but I understand you're basically solo now?
Due to circumstance. Sarah, the other half of Nervous But Excited, lives in Massachusetts now, and we're kind of just pursuing different things, but we still get together when we can and play and perform. So, you know, you never know what will happen in the future. But
I imagine there are advantages and disadvantages to that. You know, you grow accustomed to performing with somebody, and it becomes mm-hmm. pretty comfortable, and it can get pretty good. But by the same token, is it liberating to be on your own in a way?
Well, it was definitely a huge transition. You know, being up there by yourself is completely different, even if you're still singing your own, you know, a lot of your own songs with someone else up there, too. It just feels like you can count on. You can. I always had her to fall back on, no matter what.
Yeah, I totally get that.
It's a little bit more of an accountable situation now. And it was always a lot of our performance was about our banter, and we had some great energy together. So it was, you know, it's hard to still carry that. I do my best.
Understood. Well, you're sounding great here today, all by your lonesome.
Thanks.
Kate Peterson has been our Live Music Friday guest today. We'll hear another track from Kate coming up in just a little bit. So don't go away.
All right.
Today is a very tough day for us here at WKAR. We're saying goodbye to someone who means a great deal to us and to many of you as well. Over the past 26 years, Melissa Benmark has done a lot of great work here at WKAR. She is, of course, our morning edition host and produces interviews on Current State as well. Today, Melissa is retiring, not forever, she's far too young, but from Michigan State University. And ever since she broke the news, we've all been agonizing over what to say to her and how to say it. Melissa, we hope this suffices. This one's for you.
For 90.5 WKAR, I'm Melissa Benmark. Members of Congress from Michigan are urging...
For 11 and a half years, Mid-Michigan has awakened to the warm, welcoming voice of Melissa Benmark. As our faithful morning edition host, Melissa is WKAR's front door, inviting listeners in for a daily journey of information and entertainment. The truth is, Melissa has been a part of our family, and hopefully yours, for much longer. She began her time at WKAR in October 1989, and it's hard to remember a day here without Melissa's sure and steady voice.
We'd like to thank the volunteers who have been with us throughout this morning. We appreciate their coming in at early hours.
There's so much Melissa helped build at WKAR. She hosted classical music for many years and trained countless students and volunteers in the art of good radio. Melissa's a great interviewer, too, and like all the greats, she has a flair for the quirky. She can find a great story anywhere, even her own backyard.
Love is in the air, we think. Maybe. Wild turkey hens are pecking some kind of goodie out of our lawn this morning and vocalizing. Nearby, two tom turkeys stand with their feathers fully inflated, their tails fanned, their faces flashy white, and the red wattles on their necks swinging like 1970s disco chains.
Whatever the task, Melissa did it well. Her classical music expertise brought insight and enjoyment to her interviews with people like LSO conductor Timothy Muffet and pianist Ralph Vodopek.
Talk about the Second Rhapsody. Why do you think it's not performed as much as the other Gershwin works, even on this program?
Yeah, it's like saying, why isn't the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 2 not performed, because it's a wonderful piece, but it's just usurped by the Tchaikovsky number one. And
Melissa shared a golden moment with Olympic boxing medalist and Flint native Clarissa Shields.
How would you like to see your career evolve from here? What do you have on the rest of your life list? What are you, 18 now?
19? I'm 20.
20, okay. So there's some more to go, you know.
You said 18. I wish. But right now, on the agenda is going to 2016 Olympics again. We have the Olympic trials in about 2 months.
And Melissa captured the nostalgia and even the poignancy of old-time steam engines at the county fair.
Maybe, as Brunner says, there aren't a lot of kids who are as passionate about the steam engines as the older folks. But right after I talk to him, I see a group of teenagers waiting for a huge case engine to pass. They start to run across the dirt road behind it, but then one young man, maybe 13, stops and touches the pinstriped wood bunker on the back of the machine as it moves away from him. It's a gesture that says maybe the young ones still can fall in love.
Through it all, something kept Melissa going. Up before dawn each day, rain or snow. A few years ago, Melissa told us why in her own words.
The whole reason I got into public radio was because of the people, and certainly coming to WKAR, I have worked with some fantastic people, a great team, and I love that people listen and that people, you know, talk about what they hear, and that it provokes discussion, and that people even say, you know, you wake me up in the morning, and, you know, I never quite get over the novelty of going, my gosh, I guess I really do wake people up in the morning. And as someone who I will admit is not a morning person, I have never been a morning person, I understand what it is like to not want to get out of bed. And so if there's anything I can do to help that, be it giving the weather forecast or, you know, my weak attempts at humor at times, whatever it is, if it makes it a little easier for people to get out of bed, that makes me happy. So it's a great job, and I just love being here.
Hi, Melissa, it's Scott Pohl. How many times were we the only two people here at some ridiculously early hour? How many times did I greet you with, how you doing? And how many times did you reply with, still in one piece? And how many times did I reply to that with something like, I thought I saw a piece of you laying in the hallway? Anyway, have a long, happy, healthy retirement.
Oh, Melissa, I'm glad I had an office next to you because you were able to laugh at all of my singing and my jokes when no one else would. So I thank you for that. Wow, I really enjoyed working with you. I'm really going to miss you, and I hope the best for you. Take care. Sweet
Melissa. Melissa, it's your next door neighbor. You are very good at what you do, and your skills and your special way of putting them on to WKAR certainly will be missed. But enjoy the sleep, and good luck.
Melly, I've kind of thought of you as a kid's sister, having started at the station a little before you and being several years your senior. In my mind, I would have retired first, but you beat me to it. Now the only radio old-timer I'll have to reminisce with about the good old days is Scott Pohl. Thanks a lot. No, really. Thank you.
Melissa, when I moved here, you were so warm and welcoming, and you gave me a lot of great tips about how to get around Lansing and where I should eat. I'm really going to miss you and going to miss your sense of humor.
I remember first walking the halls here at WKAR, and there was Melissa's door closed, and in front of it there was this taped image of Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Bones superimposed onto the bodies of the Beatles in their Sgt. Pepper's getup. And I was like, yeah, this Melissa, she's my kind of person.
Melissa, I'm still in denial about you leaving, so I'm not going to say goodbye, but I will say thank you. Thank you for your curiosity and your sense of humor. Thank you for the thoughtfulness and warmth you brought to every current state interview you did. And thank you most of all for being such a lovely person to work with.
Melissa, when I first came here, I didn't know a thing about WKAR. I had never even been to Michigan before. I needed a lot of guidance, and you always gave me that. And lots of patience and lots of great advice. There will be another host on Morning Edition, but you're irreplaceable.
Farewell, Melissa. We'll miss you. Sleep in a little on Monday. You've earned it. But I know you won't stay without Melissa.
Yes, I know that he won't stay, yeah, without Melissa.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Monday on Current State, Lansing voters elected three new city council members just a couple of weeks ago, but the city clerk's office is looking ahead to Michigan's presidential primary in March. Clerk Chris Swope says his team has a plan to redraw the voting boundaries. We'll learn more from Chris Swope, and we'll learn more about an English language-based opera based on the Merchant Ivory film Room with a View. Of course, it was originally an E.M. Forster novel. We'll talk with the MSU Opera's director and cast of that. And on Melissa Benmark's last day, Kate Peterson has a song she wrote just before you left town here a few years ago. So there's kind of a nostalgic vibe to this.
Exactly.
We look forward to hearing it. It's called Lansing. We want to wish all of our listeners a great weekend. We wish Melissa Benmark the best of luck. We wrap up with Kate Peterson here on Current State.
Sound makes me want to write down all the things that I love about this town, like the way October leaves line my street like a bed of rose petals at my feet. And this city seems so small. 'Cause I know faces everywhere I go, and I feel so full with my friends surrounding me. Just cross the street, you know where to find me. And I watch my rear view down one-way streets just to get a perspective unfamiliar to me. Sit by the river in the heart of the city just to feel its beat inside of me. That's why I love this city in all its simple beauties. On these streets I stroll like sidewalks. I feel strong in this steady home. It makes me think it's time to roam. And I watch my